We're talking about the Great Lakes salinity on the rise, with road salt being a big culprit. It is the Great Lakes in focus on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. Limnologists, they say, look, we're doing better, but we must reevaluate how much salt we're putting down and how it's regulated. And of course, there are other inputs beyond road de-icer that have scientists really worried and projecting a rise in chloride levels for Lake Michigan in the decades to come. Have you taken steps to use less salt on your walkways? What are you curious about with salt and the Great Lakes? 800-642-1234. Hillary Dugan is an assistant professor at UW-Madison Center for Limnology. She's lead author on a recent study about salt loading into Lake Michigan. Hillary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Happy to be here.
Hi. Can you start by putting your numbers you arrived at in perspective on Lake Michigan so that we can visualize what 1 million metric tons of salt is? Help us understand what this load is like.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to imagine that in one place, it would certainly be a lot of salt. We have to keep in mind that Lake Michigan and the Great Lakes are basically inland oceans. They are immense volumes of water. And so when we dump a million tons of salt into one of those lakes, it's going to dilute it pretty quickly. And that's a good thing. And so what we see is that the concentrations are rising very slowly because the bodies of water are just so big. But at the same time, there are hundreds of rivers that flow into Lake Michigan, and the watersheds are relatively small. But, you know, all of that salt that's being put down in the Lake Michigan watershed, so most of the east coast of Wisconsin, is flowing, you know, directly into Lake Michigan.
I would imagine that the salinity you're talking about is not near the level of what you would find in seawater or in our salty oceans. Can you explain the difference?
Yeah. So freshwater is usually delineated as being less than 1 gram per liter of salt, which is extremely low. We're talking, you know, a teaspoon of salt in a few liters of water, whereas the ocean is about 35 grams per liter of salt. So we're not even close to being at those concentrations in the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes are still extremely fresh water. But that, again, is because they are such big bodies of water. In smaller inland lakes and rivers, we do sometimes see concentrations that get pretty salty, get close to looking like the ocean. Certainly in things like urban storm sewers and rivers, those concentrations can be just exceedingly high. But when all that salt is sort of coming into one place, like the Great Lakes, that again dilutes. And so the concentrations are still really fresh water. We're really fortunate to have these big volumes of fresh water. But we do see concentrations going up really slowly over time.
You mentioned urban areas and very high salinity in some watersheds. So where does all the salt come from? Why is that the case?
Yeah, you mentioned this in your intro. There's different sources of salt. Definitely the elephant in the room is road salt. One reason for that is just we use it everywhere. You know, everywhere there's roads, there's usually some form of de-icing going on, especially in a state like Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And the more roads you have, the more people you have, urban areas, we just use a lot more of that. So in Wisconsin, counties like Dane County, Milwaukee County, Waukesha, you know, areas where there's just dense urban populations, we tend to see more road salt use. And so thinking about the Great Lakes watershed, those counties like Milwaukee County, all of that salt's going to flow into rivers like the Milwaukee River, Menominee River, Kinnickinnick, and flow into the Milwaukee Harbor and kind of mix in with Lake Michigan water. And so, you know, those are the type of rivers where we see really high concentrations. We see high concentrations near, you know, the Milwaukee Airport. And we see high concentrations in the Lake Michigan watershed and some of the big rivers on the eastern shore, so coming from the state of Michigan as well. Luckily for Lake Michigan, a lot of the watershed is still non-urban. So thinking about northeast Wisconsin, up north of Door County, the UP, still really forested, and rivers up there have, you know, natural background concentrations of salt, which is almost immeasurable. Sort of naturally, there's almost no salt in the waters. So that's a good thing too.
Talking with the lead author on a recent study about the amount of salt loading into Lake Michigan, Hillary Dugan with us, assistant professor at UW-Madison Center for Limnology. You can join in. Do you live on a shore of the Great Lakes? Do you visit Lake Michigan or Lake Superior? What do you want people to know about the fresh water? What concerns you about the salt flow? 800-642-1234. Hillary, just out of curiosity, I read a news report yesterday from 1982, and the rising salinity on Lake Michigan has been happening for decades. And I want to know, what is new about this problem now?
Yeah, it has been happening for decades. What's interesting in the Great Lakes in particular is that the concentrations in all five Great Lakes were rising, and with the institution of the Clean Water Act in 1972. So that's 50 years ago now. We saw a big decrease in some of the concentrations in the lower lakes, so Lake Ontario, Lake Erie, and that was due to industrial sources being effectively shut off. You know, there was regulation that got put in place saying we couldn't dump pollutants straight into the lakes. So that had a big effect. But after the Clean Water Act, we've seen this resurgence and sort of the slow rise in salinity, and that's from less from industrial sources and more from these, we call them non-point sources, so more distributed, things like road salt. We're putting it down everywhere. It's coming in all the rivers, as opposed to industrial sources, which sometimes are easier to regulate because it's sort of one geographic point. Mm-hmm. And so the switch in terms of what we're trying to regulate has gotten more difficult. And so that's a recurring problem when it comes to water quality, which is sources of pollutants that are geographically distributed. So we find that with nutrient runoff as well. It's hard to shut off when you're seeing it in so many places.
What about the effects of home water softeners? You know, the salt, huge salt bags we pour into these water softeners.
Yeah. So we've been talking about road salt thus far, but water softeners is also a really big contributor of salt to freshwater environments. So Madison's a great example of a city where a lot of people have water softeners because we drink groundwater. That water is extremely hard. And so when you put salt in your water softener, that salt will get sent to the wastewater treatment plant. Then they don't have capacity to remove that salt. Removing salt from water is extremely expensive and it's just not economically feasible. Mm-hmm. So all of that salt is being sent downstream wherever the wastewater treatment plant discharges their effluent. So in this case, in Madison's case, it would be the Rock River. The Rock River then flows into the Mississippi, and that salt sort of goes cascading through different freshwater environments. Thinking about the Great Lakes, a lot of Great Lakes residents drink Great Lakes water, mm-hmm. which is much softer because it's the surface water. And so if you're living in the Great Lakes watershed, there's a higher likelihood you don't have a water softener. And so luckily, in those watersheds, you might not see as much of an influence of water softeners.
Don't I wish I was on Lake Superior water? My goodness.
Y'all do.
I know. How do aquatic plants respond to more salt in the water? What about the ecosystems in the Great Lakes?
So there's a lot of research going on right now thinking about kind of the ecotoxicology of salt pollution. And I think we can think about plants and animals the same way, knowing that a lot of our native species are, you know, have evolved to really freshwater environments. And if we think back before, you know, before humans started dumping salt everywhere, extremely low salt concentrations in all of our freshwater. Nothing in Wisconsin was adapted to saltier environments. And so as we add salt to rivers, lakes, anything that's living in them, be that plants or animals, are going to be stressed by those rising salinities. It kind of throws off the osmoregulation of these species. And some plants and animals are able to deal with that better.
Some adapt.
Some evolve, especially if you have short lifespans. So there's a good chance that, you know, smaller microbial species will, you know, might evolve to higher salt concentrations. But at the same time, it's also creating a habitat that's really attractive to non-native invasive species that tend to be generalist. They tend to be, sometimes they come from saltier environments. So we think of things like zebra mussels, you know, they came from brackish environments in Europe. Mm-hmm. They do not care about rising salinities. So if anything, we are going to see habitats that are doing the disservice to our native species and not going to stop invasive species from being there either.
UW-Madison limnologist Hillary Dugan with us studies lakes, their salinity, how road salt, other activities affect water quality. Are you concerned about the amount of salt flowing into the Great Lakes? Does Wisconsin use too much, too little on the roads? Do you live on one of the Great Lakes? What do you want people to know? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Hillary Dugan here on the Ideas Network. The Great Lakes, they hold about one-fifth of our planet's fresh water, steadily becoming saltier. We're learning about possible solutions to help curb the rising salt pollution on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Lake Michigan, researchers found that chloride concentrations, that is an element in salt, they have increased dramatically since the 1800s. What would be a corrective action that is feasible if the salt problem is irreversible? Do you think the level of salt is affecting fish populations or other parts of the ecosystem? What do you observe on the Great Lakes? 800-642-1234. UW-Madison limnologist Hillary Dugan with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring on Jeff now in Appleton. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. Hi, Jeff. Are you there?
This is an interesting... Yes. Are you hearing me?
We can hear you now. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm interested in program today, and I guess my question is, what alternatives do we have for reducing the salt, say, by 50% or, you know, without inhibiting the safety of our roads during the winter?
Can we even decrease it by 50% in half, Hillary?
Yeah, so great question, Jeff. And I think 50% is a great number and target to start with. And in Wisconsin, I think we're fortunate to have a Department of Transportation who is pretty invested in salt reduction. You know, they see the environmental concern. They also see the economic concern. Salt is getting a lot more expensive. The cost to, you know, winter maintenance is a big part of their budget. And what we're seeing in a lot of counties in Wisconsin is a switch to more liquid applications. So you see brine trucks sort of spraying liquid salt down instead of using solid rock salt. And it's the same salt. They just mix it into a liquid solution before applying it. But what that means is that it sticks to the road better. It doesn't just sort of bounce off the road into the ditch. And so it's a lot more effective and they end up using a lot less salt. And so what we're seeing in Wisconsin is counties that use a lot more liquid application. The shining example is Jefferson County, has seen a 50% reduction in their salt use in the last few years. So that's a big step towards salt reduction. And what we're seeing is it can reduce loads up to 50%. I think after that, the next step is thinking about private application. So not municipal roads, thinking about things like parking lots, sidewalks, you know, how do you maintain spaces where people feel safe, but yet, you know, don't need to be over salted because they're flat, you're driving slowly, things like that.
Jeff, thank you for that question. We also heard from Eric in Wausau, called in, couldn't stay. And Eric says, you often see in urban areas, Hillary, they dump excess snow near the wetlands. And Eric doesn't understand why they do that. Could that increase salt in the wetland areas, in the water?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Yeah, lots of cities, especially ones that are near bodies of water, will just dump their plowed snow just right into the water. And in some ways, that's just speeding up that salt introduction into the environment. If you're kind of piling it in one place, sort of localizing that pollution. But we have to keep in mind that no matter where you dump your salt, it's going to get into the environment. So, you know, all the salt we put down is getting into the terrestrial environment and eventually the aquatic environment because salt dissolves in water. So it's going to flow where the water flows and it's going to pollute groundwater. It's going to pollute rivers, wetlands. And so piling it up in one spot is really just localizing it. But, you know, no one's going out and picking up salt. So no matter where we put it, it's going to cause pollution.
Is this irreversible? I mean, what can you do for remedies? I mean, how is salt different from other chemicals that pollute our lakes?
Yeah, that's important. It's absolutely reversible, which is great. There's a lot of water quality problems that we deal with that are much harder to remediate once we've polluted them. But salt stays dissolved in water. And so we don't see salt, you know, building up in the food web or sticking around in the sediments. It stays dissolved in the water. And so water bodies will eventually flush themselves out. You know, incoming precipitation, snow melt should flush that salt downstream. And so all it takes to reverse these trends is to stop using so much salt. And as we start to use less salt, we're going to see improvements. The big unknown is really just how much salt is out there on the landscape. You know, how much salt is sitting in soils, sitting in ditches, sort of waiting to be flushed out. And it's unclear what that lag time will be in seeing these trends go down.
Can we look elsewhere to other states for solutions? New Hampshire, they have this program called Green Snow Pro, where salt applicators can be certified and you hire them. They're granted limited liability protection against damages from snow and ice. And just wondering, where can you look elsewhere in the country for reducing salt use?
Yeah, so a lot of states are trying to tackle this at the same time, and a lot of states are working together as well. So in Wisconsin, we do have certification. Wisconsin Saltwise is a network that does a lot of certifications, which is great. The limitation is that there's no sort of follow-up step to that to, you know, ensure people are using best management practices. And what you mentioned, which is unique to New Hampshire, is this idea of limited liability. A lot of people oversalt because there's this perception of litigation. So people are concerned that, you know, especially business owners, that, you know, if they don't completely clear their sidewalk and parking lot, they might be sued for a slip and fall case. I think this is more of a perceived notion, but it certainly could happen. And it's, in most people's minds, it's cheaper to apply a lot of salt than it is to get sued, right? Mm-hmm. So what they've done in New Hampshire is say that, you know, as long as you're using best management practices and are not, you know, grossly negligent of your property, you know, we're going to protect you from those instances, and hoping that then allows people to feel comfortable taking more sort of environmentally friendly methods of, you know, maintaining their property in the winter.
Hillary Dugan with us, assistant professor of UW-Madison Center for Limnology Studies, lakes, and talking about salinity in the Great Lakes. With your questions, 800-642-1234. Hillary, climate change, Wisconsin winters warming. How could climate change affect our use of salting roads?
Climate change is going to be a big factor, and it's going to affect different parts of the state differently. So what we see in Wisconsin is winter is the fastest changing season. It's warming pretty rapidly, much more so than summer. And in the south, that might mean less snow. If you have less storms, maybe you use less road salt. We've had an interesting winter in the southern half of the state this year where there's just been such low amounts of precipitation. I think the only time it snows is when you have me on the radio talking about reducing salt use.
We time it that way. We know so things.
The skiers will finally be happy. But you know, it's what that means is that the counties and the cities just haven't had to use a lot of salt, which is great. And you know, if in the future there's less storms, that means less salt. In the north, maybe there's going to be an opposite trend where, you know, the northern counties had a really cold winter. It's too cold to use road salt. It's also too cold for it to be really icy. You know, ice forms when we see freeze-thaw cycles, which is really common in southern Wisconsin. If the north gets warmer, their climate might be more similar to southern Wisconsin, in which case, you know, they might need more salt to deal with sort of ice problems. Whereas now it's really easy to just plow the snow. You still have good traction in these really cold temperatures.
Well, Hillary, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to be here, Kate.
Hillary Dugan is an assistant professor at UW-Madison Center for Limnology. She is lead author of the Lake Michigan Salt Loading Study, published in the journal Limnology and Oceanography Letters. We have a link to her study at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, it's more conversation on the Great Lakes and you. We have a Milwaukee-based printmaker and mixed media artist whose Great Lakes educational videos have gained more than 1 million followers. We'll talk with her. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're hearing from a range of voices centered on the Great Lakes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So there's a Milwaukee-based mixed media collage artist who takes found objects from the Great Lakes and creates art with them. And she can tell us everything there is to know about Milwaukee's Bradford Beach, where she draws so much inspiration from. Geo Rutherford says the beach is like an old mother who has gone through a lot of changes, and her art speaks to all the environmental tensions facing the Great Lakes, or a lot of them at least. What have you found walking along the shoreline of Lake Michigan or Lake Superior? What has that taught you? What insights have you gleaned? 800-642-1234. Geo Rutherford, printmaker and adjunct art instructor at UW-Milwaukee. Geo, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you moved to Milwaukee several years ago. First time you've lived near a really big body of water. And it sounds like this has really changed you and what you do and see through your art.
Yeah, I had no idea. I moved here from Ann Arbor, but before that I was in Boulder, Colorado. And that's a place where we don't actually have access to this type of water. I mean, there's no lakes like the Great Lakes. So
I just appreciate those images of you walking along Bradford Beach and just saying what comes to your mind as you look out there on the beach and you look out at the water. What is it about that place for you that says so much about your art?
I think Bradford Beach was kind of accidental. I decided to work on my MFA thesis and I picked the topic of the Great Lakes a little bit arbitrarily, where I wasn't really planning too far ahead. I kind of just decided, okay, I'm going to do this on the Great Lakes. And I read Dan Egan's book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. And I decided that the best way to glean inspiration was to just go every day. I think a ritual can really help kind of inspire an artist to create. And I didn't know what I was doing when I first started going. I just started to turn up and I'd go for a walk and I would kind of appreciate this threshold between the sand and the water. And I realized how much evidence is being turned over by the water to the shore, and how there's just all sorts of things that you can find along the beach, but not just plastic articles of the Anthropocene, but also natural objects that are interesting factors in the Great Lakes story. And so I just kind of started to collect stuff and it kind of spiraled from there. And now I have boxes of trash in my studio.
but these, it's really interesting. I mean, as you look out at the water, you can't understand the story of what lies really beneath it, but you see all of these things either wash up on the beach or land on the beach, and they kind of give you hints of what's happening to the Great Lakes.
Exactly. I was really fascinated by that. When you're standing on the edge, this like precipice between the sand and the water, you just cannot understand, comprehend, appreciate the sheer scale of the Great Lakes, what's going on ecologically with the Great Lakes, what's going on because of climate change with the Great Lakes. All of those things are so hard to interpret when you're just looking over the water. Even if you fly over the water, even if you have a way to transport yourself on the water in boat or other forms, it still is such an unimaginable thing to kind of penetrate and understand. So instead I spend my time on the shore where there's just tiny pieces or hints, like you said, evidence that has been turned over to give us clues about what's going on.
So, you know, you're sifting through all this stuff, these old sunglasses and the Barbie head, all these random items that turn up on the beach. And then you've got all these test tubes. What are you doing here with the art?
So that was kind of accidental. I was going to the beach, and at the same time, I was taking a independent study class with the university library specialist. His name is Max Yella. He's in charge of the special collections at the university. And he was giving me these crazy prompts where he'd say, okay, Gio, you need to make a book about single image transformation, or you need to make a book about film, or you need to make a book about aura. And one week he sent me home with the test of making a book about group, which might seem kind of unimaginative, but for me, it sent me down this spiral where I had all this trash in my studio. And I also had this vintage set of glass test tubes that I had picked up along the way, probably 10 years ago. And as an artist, you kind of just hold on to the stuff that has potential. So I took the tubes, I put the material I found on the beach into the tubes, and I turned it in as a project. And he was excited about it, and we talked about it a lot. And from there, I had new iterations of the book. I call it a book, even though it's a bunch of glass tubes. And I just recreated this a few different times. I kind of perfected it. And then I had this beautiful artist book with a Manet Noir lithograph on the cover. And when you open it up, you're greeted by this set of burnt umber kind of tube rubber caps, and you don't know what you're looking at. Just like when you're standing on the edge of the shore, when you look at the book from the surface, you can't see what's inside. You can't see what's going on, and you have to go through tube at a time. And I jokingly say that you have to pick up the tube and turn it just like you turn a page. You have to read the materials. You have to engage with the items that have been discovered on Great Lakes beaches. And as you get to the end of this book, as you've picked through all of the tubes, you have a greater understanding of what the Great Lakes beaches look like. And you kind of leave with a narrative that has formed from the materials found in the sand.
Are you a collector at heart? I mean, this sounds like, as you organize all of these things into little test tubes, I mean, what's going on there in your brain?
I feel like it was kind of accidental. I'm actually kind of anti-collection. I've been, in my adult life, I've been trying to get rid of our connection with stuff. Like, I don't, even though I love books, I don't collect them. And even though I love music, I don't collect records. I'm kind of anti a lot of junk in my pocket. And so it was really funny. My parents were laughing when I suddenly started bringing home pounds of trash from the beach, because it's just not really who I am as a person. But now it just kind of, it really is so much. I can't tell you how fun it is to like dig through your piles of trash to find goodies. It's so fun to go through stuff and organize it and put it in the tubes. Like, it is a thrilling experience. It might not seem like it is, but it's really fun.
What would be an example of some rare goodies that you rarely find on the beach, but sometimes you come across them?
So I get super excited on Bradford's kind of an interesting beach, because I spent a long time going to it and kind of like honoring it and really thinking about it, all of this stuff. And I found out later, I did part of my thesis about how it's completely artificial. Like, that beach was constructed by man. And all of the material, all the sand was just dumped there to kind of create this artificial shoreline. All of Lake Park is kind of this artificial shore to try to protect the escarpment from the beach and the water. So when I started going there, I get so excited when I find brachiopod fossils and crinoid fossils. Those were like a thrill of something that kind of exists from this, 300 million year old Silurian sea. But I'm actually not sure if they were meant to be there, if they were part of this artificial shoreline. I get excited about things like pirate's glass. Do you know what that is?
No, explain.
So pirate's glass is black glass, but it's very deceptive. It just looks like a black rock. And when you pick it up, you might just discard it and think, oh, this isn't really much of anything. But when you take it home, or you even just pull out your phone and you put a flashlight under it, it will glow. a different color. So I have green pirate's glass and blue pirate's glass and red pirate's glass. So that, and purple pirate's glass, it's kind of an interesting phenomenon that's really rare, but I sometimes find it. I find marbles occasionally, which I am thrilled by. I love finding marbles. I like finding any type of barrette. I've moved on past like feeling a bit of disgust about plastic on our beaches. Obviously it's not great, but now I'm on this like hunt for the thrill of finding a piece of Barbie toy or a Lego piece or a barrette or something that is just been kept intact by the water, and I am now the recipient of this thing that exists on the shore. And I get so thrilled by certain types of plastic that I find, which is, I think, part of the reason I've kept going. Even though a lot of it is gross, I still get so excited when I find even just the strangest childlike remnant, like the little army men or little plastic animals. Like, those are like the thrill of the hunt for sure.
We're talking with Geo Rutherford, adjunct art teacher, UW-Milwaukee, teaching foundations of art, and talking about her artwork about the Great Lakes, printmaking as well. You can join in. What have you found on the beach or in the water of the Great Lakes? Did you keep it? Share your story, 800-642-1234. Bring us into your printmaking, because you say that it's the perfect way for talking about invasive species. What about the prints?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting because I'm trying to like look at the Great Lakes and think about all the different components. So we were kind of just talking about trash, but another thing that you find on the Great Lakes beaches in droves, in millions, in billions even, is quagga and zebra mussels. And so I have this massive collection of those. I've been looking at them and collecting them. But they're the only real remnant of this story of invasive species for the Great Lakes. They're kind of the latest of this story. If you were walking along the beaches in the 1960s, you may have been bombarded by the scent of alewives rotting on the shore. Or if 10 years before that, you may have encountered a sea lamprey or two in the sand. And so printmaking is kind of an interesting medium because it's inherently repetitious. You can make a stamp, make a block print, you can make a lithographic print, an etching. No matter what you make, you can then print it hundreds of times, thousands of times, and it replicates itself just the way that invasive species do on the Great Lakes. They come in multiples, their populations usually explode. And that's what you can kind of emulate through printmaking, which I think is such a fascinating connection.
Oh, that is. That's really fascinating. You know, when you pick up these mussels, what about the color? What do they look like? How does that inform your art?
So I actually really love this sounds terrible because we obviously do not want mussels in the Great Lakes, but I love the zebra mussels. Like, quagga mussels have come more recently. They're the more common mussels now in the Great Lakes because they can attach to sand. So they were able to do something the zebra mussels were never able to do. So the quagga mussels are kind of white and sharp and very like bleached looking, but the zebra mussels are like super contrasted. They have these beautiful stripes to them. So I get excited when I find perfectly intact zebra mussels, especially like I have a beautiful sample where they're attached to styrofoam. And there's this like beautiful set of zebra mussels attached to this gnarly piece of styrofoam. So I find a lot of inspiration from that when I'm on the beach. I love the way that they look, even though obviously like they cut your feet, they're bad for the environment. Like, there's all these terrible things about them. And yet I still pick them up and get a little excited. So
mixed media artist Geo Rutherford with us focuses her work on the Great Lakes, elevates the meaning of her art through TikTok videos. Have you seen an increase in trash along the Lake Michigan shoreline? What concerns you about what's washing up on the beaches? How do you see your art through the lens of the Great Lakes? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Geo Rutherford here on the Ideas Network. Can you tell a story in a minute? Can you explain your art in 60 seconds? Milwaukee-based artist Geo Rutherford thinks about that a lot. We're looking at the Great Lakes through her printmaking and mixed media collages on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Gio uses her short form videos on TikTok to help educate about the Great Lakes and share her art that is inspired by the freshwater system. Still time to talk about how your art is informed by the Great Lakes, one of its beaches, human-made or otherwise, 800-642-1234. Gio Rutherford with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Tamara now in Ashland. Hi, Tamara. What are your memories of Bradford Beach?
Hey, hello there. I'm actually Tamara, and I remember playing as a child on Bradford Beach in my uncle swimming out to the reservoir that, like you said, was the man-made water purification center. And I used to find trilobites with my father right there in the rocks along the shoreline. And what you said about it being an old woman is very, very true. All the Great Lakes are just magical and giving, and we have to pay more attention to them and be creative about how we express their beauty. And I think it's great what you're doing.
Oh, Tamara, this is such a beautiful story. Gio, you must be thrilled to hear this.
Oh yeah, I've never found a trilobite. I'm kind of jealous, and I love that that's a memory for you because the beach is so wonderful and gives so much.
Have you been back, Tamara? Have you been back to the beach since your childhood?
Yes, I'm actually going for a memorial for my brother in River West. And we are all celebrating our lives on Lake Michigan. We use the word bubbler since we were children. And right now I'm enjoying Ashland, Wisconsin. The water is just as beautiful here. Mother Superior, we call her.
Oh, thank you so much for calling in. Really appreciate that story. Terry now in Milwaukee. Terry, hi, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, good morning. You were asking about things that we find on the beach. For a number of years, I vacationed with my family in Door County, and I would go to some of the lakeside beaches to pick up stones so the grandchildren could paint on them. And I remember being on the beach one day and found a simple stone, a little smaller than the size of my hand, round and smooth. And I thought to myself, if I had not grabbed that stone and let it lay there, and it was probably the size of a pickup truck 100, 200 years ago. And it was reduced to the size that I picked it up at because of being banged around by the waves and by the other stones around it. And I got to thinking, you know, that life is like that. You mature, you get banged around all different directions, and sometimes you find yourself being reduced to something smaller than you really want it to be. So I grabbed the stone, and I have it on my desk even to this day, and it reminds me that I have to create events in my life to stop from being reduced to a pebble of sand, and that stone helps me to do that.
Terry, thank you so much for sharing that story. I mean, how beautiful, Gio, to think about those pebbles in that way along the shoreline.
Yeah, it's an interesting place for that kind of connection because you wouldn't really necessarily pick up that stone anywhere else. There's something about the water on the stone next on the shore that just changes our relationship to it.
Let's go to Rona now in Grace Lake. Rona, hi. Do I have your name pronounced right?
Rana.
Oh, Rana. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rana.
No worries. So, I just recently retired from teaching. I was a science teacher, and I was always so frustrated thinking about how to teach environmental science, a little with limited field trips and being able to get outside, and which really is so impactful when you're talking about some certain subject areas. And when your guest talked about invasive species and how making that print multiples and thousands of times, and I thought, wow, you know, there it was right in front of me, and I couldn't see it because STEM was so part of my world, and STEAM, the integration of art into science, was just kind of floating around there. What a brilliant idea, and I just really hope more people can take advantage of that. Maybe there people are already doing it, and I'm behind the curve, but bravo on that, bringing that into education. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Rana. And, you know, I think it seems, Gio, that you too found art because you were turning away a little bit from the hard sciences?
My mother is a geologist, which is why my name is Geo, and she was a teacher for a long time. She was at Edgewood College here in Madison, and I was definitely always inspired by her, and you know, we communicate a lot about different ways that science and art can integrate. So I really appreciate when teachers can look at my work and think, oh yeah, that's such an interesting way to talk about invasive species or the Great Lakes. Like, how can we create a conversation about art, education, and science all together?
Something you have also done is these TikTok videos that have gotten so many views. What prompted you to take your work to TikTok?
The first thing that actually went really viral for me was my second video I ever posted, and it was about that book I was describing with the tubes. And I shared about that on the app, and it got over 1 million views. And from there, it kind of just, you know, snowballed, and I kept making videos. It was in the middle of the lockdown, so everything kind of got away from me. And after about a month, I started to make educational content, because as I was a teacher, a high school teacher, and I enjoy education, and I enjoy the giddiness of finding new things out and then sharing them. So I started to do educational videos about, you know, the Great Lakes, and then I started doing it about all lakes, and then I kind of started to do videos about just water, anything. And now I Am Where I Am, which is a platform about education and science, but it's also a space where I can share about the artwork I'm doing, which relates to all of those prior things. So it's kind of an interesting platform.
It's all kind of coming together there with education and art, a bit of activism, I think, in the mix as well.
Yes, definitely.
Well, Geo, thank you so much for joining us, and appreciate that we could appreciate your art.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It was really wonderful.
Geo Rutherford, an adjunct art teacher at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, specializing in printmaking. Her artwork focuses on the Great Lakes. We have a link to her TikTok channel. It's at WPR.org/mornings. And in addition, there is a short film about Geo's artwork by Thomas Sawyer. And earlier, we talked with UW-Madison limnologist Hillary Dugan. You can go back, listen to all of our Great Lakes conversations, and share your ideas at WPR.org/mornings. Now, just a heads up here, starting Monday, the morning show will be starting 1 hour later. The morning show will start 1 hour later at 7 a.m. Monday, be live the whole time until 9 o'clock every weekday. And this later start time means you'll hear an extra hour of news and information programs from the BBC World Service. This starts Monday, so please, heads up on that. We start at 7. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.